Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, clinical sexologist, with Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander, will you please introduce our guest?
Our guest today is Dallas Denny. Dallas is an applied behavior analyst, a writer, editor, and musician. She's an activist and gender theorist who has worked on behalf of gender variant people since the 1980s. In 1991, she founded the influential nonprofit American Educational Gender Information Service, or AEGIS, perhaps, A-E-G-I-S, which in those pre-internet days was sort of like a Google for all things. In other words, it was where people went, or trans people went, to find resources, and hopefully where they also went to find each other. Dallas has written 5 books, more than 20 book chapters, and hundreds of articles. She edited the journals Chrysalis Quarterly and Transgender Tapestry for nearly 10 years each, and has been involved with starting and running at least 5 transgender conferences. Her writing and music is available at DallasDenny.com. Welcome to the show, Dallas.
Hi, thank you very much.
What got you started in running transgender conferences? What were they? Yeah, anything you want to tell us about those conferences? Are any of them still going now?
I'll start with Transgender Week, which was known until a couple of years ago as Fantasia Fair. It's held every October. This will be the 50th anniversary in Provincetown on Cape Cod. And I was asked to be on the board in 1992, and I thought, well, this is a meeting for crossdressers, and I'm transsexual, and I don't know how I can help, but sure, I'll be on the board. And I went there, and of course, it wasn't just trans crossdressers; it was every kind of trans person, trans masculine, trans feminine people, people we would today call non-binary. And I'm still involved with running that. It's a fantastic event, and I look forward to going to Cape Cod every October. After I moved to Atlanta, there were trans conferences around in other parts of the country, for instance, the BEAL in the Midwest and IFGE's conference, which moved around. And Sabrina Marcus stopped by the IFG office one day and said, we want you to put on a conference in the South. And they said, well, we won't, but we'll show you how to do it. So they flew down and all the groups in the South got together and had a meeting and planned a conference, which was Southern Comfort, which ran until the board moved it to Florida about 6 or 7 years ago, I guess it is now. At an IFGE meeting, there were about 15 trans men. They were trying to provide programming for the trans men and really kind of botching it up. And some of the trans men were pretty frustrated. So I thought about it and I came home and I sent out a press release that said that AEGIS would provide $500 for starting a national conference for trans men if some nonprofit would match the money. And then I called Dr. Jameson Green and gave him a heads up. And he procured the promises for the $500. And then I had to struggle to actually find $500. So I triggered the first trans men's conference in the United States, and that ran for some years. When Southern Comfort moved to Florida, we started a conference called THEA, Transgender Health and Education Alliance, and we had 2 conferences before the organization folded. And then I got involved with Paradise Conference to help them get started. And I was actually the keynote speaker there this weekend. I got to go to Atlanta for the first time since the pandemic. So I think that's 5.
We've had Jameson Green on the show, and I remember him talking about the first FTM conference at FTM International put on in 1995 in San Francisco. But I didn't know the history behind it as far as the financing. So thank you very much.
I couldn't afford to attend. It just killed me, but I didn't. And we did an all Jason Cromwell, who's a trans man and an anthropologist, edited a special issue of Chrysalis, and I sent 500 copies up to the conference, and there weren't enough. They ran out because the conference was so well attended. And this is interesting because the clinicians were saying, even in the early 90s, that there were very few trans men compared to trans feminine people, and that they were exclusively sexually attracted to females. And I was doing a book for Garland. It was an edited textbook called Current Concepts in Transgender Identity, because I was trying to get across the idea that there's a healthy transgender model and not the I'm trapped in the wrong body model that was happening. One of the authors said just that about trans men. There's only a few compared to trans women, and they're exclusively attracted. And I told him about Lou Sullivan, and he still refused to change his chapter. It was really irritating.
I think that even today, a lot of people hold that view. Fewer trans men than trans women, and that the majority, if not all of us, are attracted to females, to women. I think a lot of people still hold that because I'm not out in the social media world, so I don't really know what's happening. But when I get together in a group that's large enough, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more trans men, if there is a gay identifying trans man in the crowd, they will make remarks about how this is the first time they've ever met another gay trans man. So even in their local vicinities, they're having trouble meeting each other. It might be the case that we're the majority, but I don't even know if that's true. It just might be where we go for our social networking is different, so we're not meeting each other.
I think for Generation Z people, there are more people that are female-bodied at birth than male-bodied. And it's so interesting that it can flip-flop. And the models have changed, but sometimes old ideas lie hard.
You have published a lot. And then even working with those two magazines, Chrysalis and the Transgender Studies Quarterly, what kind of work is it that you've done outside of your trans world involvement? What kinds of work have you done that has lent to this ability to write a lot, do research, and be involved in these ways?
I was in a doctoral program at Vanderbilt University at Peabody College at Vanderbilt. I did not get my ticket punched because the department chair, after I transitioned, refused to hold the oral exam, which then made the clock keep ticking, and it eventually ran out even though I was taking courses in Georgia to replace stuff as it fell off the top. I put it back in. But I got a license in Tennessee, which is one of the few states, or was, I don't think they do it anymore, but they license people to practice psychology at the master's level. So I got a license to practice psychology in Tennessee, and I worked for the state of Tennessee as an applied behavior analyst until I transitioned in 1989, so almost 15, 17 years maybe. And after I transitioned and moved to Atlanta, not knowing if I would ever have another professional job again, I landed one immediately and did exactly the same work with developmentally disabled adults until I retired. And I eventually let my license lapse because there was no need for it in Georgia, and it was pretty clear I wasn't going to be heading back to Tennessee anytime soon.
That gave you the background in writing and research. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was fascinating work. I felt like I was halfway a detective trying to figure out why my clients were behaving the way they were, and then having to devise a plan to change that behavior because some of it was destructive to themselves and others. Sometimes I felt like a sumo wrestler because some of the clients were really, really out of control. Usually, more than often than not, I found that staff were the cause of the problem behaviors, problem in air quotes. I liked that work. I was afraid to take typing in high school because I thought it might brand me. I was very lucky that I never got teased. I could perform maleness just enough. Actually, I could perform it very well, but I performed it just enough to not be suspect. But I thought taking typing would be one step over the line. So we were in a thrift shop, and I talked my mother into buying an old Woodstock typewriter from the 20s for $8. And I came home and put duct tape over the keys and taught myself to type. So I knew how to type, and that was huge. I write fiction, I write songs, I write poetry, I write short stories, everything. I had done some scientific stuff over my course of getting my graduate degree and my work. So I just realized I was really well positioned to start an organization like Aegis.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about Aegis and what do you do?
I had zero information growing up. I knew exactly who I was by age probably 13 and what I wanted to do, and absolutely no idea how to go about doing it. And I knew no one like myself. And I could find in the library in my little town, I went just before I started high school, and I looked up all the terms I knew, which weren't many, and I found two books. And one was supposed to be on the shelves, and it still wasn't on the shelf after I had graduated from high school. The other was in reserve, which would have required me to tell the librarian, who might have called my parents. So I just had nothing until I think I came across Kessler and McKenna's book at a scientific conference in the late 80s, which was instrumental. And I attended the gender clinic at Vanderbilt University in the late 70s, and they told me I was not dysfunctional enough to be transsexual. They said, you were married for 6 years, you're sexually attracted to women, you have two college degrees, you have a job as a child protective services worker with the state of Tennessee, so we're not going to offer you hormones or surgery, which told me, okay, hormones and surgery, that's what I need to be doing. But also it was told me that I was just not as dysfunctional as they thought all transsexuals were, because they were stereotyping us as having pretty much every kind of personality and character disorder imaginable, and then filling the medical literature with their ideas. So I went to the medical library after I was rejected, and all the literature backed them up. And I realized that the literature was like a snake eating its own tail. I was just crushed when they rejected me. And it was 10 years before I really found community. But after the Vanderbilt incident, I forged a prescription for hormones and put myself on estrogen at age 29, which made a huge difference in my life because it's prepared me physically for when I was able to transition.
That reminds me of the way it used to be, the research that was done on, quote, the homosexual community. And it was predominantly done on gay men and lesbian women who were incarcerated or institutionalized or had an addiction, something with addiction, they were in treatment. So they were only looking at those individuals when they were first starting to do their research. So they had all these assumptions about what a, quote, homosexual was. And it was deviant and disturbed, right? Because they were interacting with people who had committed some crime or were struggling, right, with mental illness.
It's an absolute parallel. And then you're getting consequences for being functional. Whereas if you were not functioning, perhaps you would. And certainly people that do have mental illnesses and drug issues certainly are in need of gender-affirming medical treatment. But so was I, and I didn't get it. And that politicized me.
I remember having a conversation with a trans man that I knew in graduate school. This is before I transitioned, about maybe 3 years before. And I remember him saying to me that if I didn't feel like I was born in the wrong body and I didn't feel like I wanted to kill myself, I wasn't really trans.
We police that as a community. I've written about that recently. I had a friend that was kicked out of her support group because she wasn't moving forward with her transition fast enough. She wasn't on hormones. Well, she was poor as a church mouse and she couldn't even afford to see the therapist, much less buy the hormones. And they kicked her out of her group. And meanwhile, in the cross-dressing groups, because the groups there were either founded by Virginia Prince or were offshoots of pretty much you had to be a heterosexual crossdresser to be in those groups. Yet there was a lot of sexual experimentation and there were a lot of people there with the same kind of issues that I as a transsexual was having, wanting to change their bodies, wanting to cross live. And there was a whole lot of hypocrisy and covering that up by those organizations. And that's another thing that politicized me because in the end, it was the wives who they supposedly were doing it all for who were being snowed the most. Of course, your husband doesn't want to be on hormones. Of course, your husband doesn't think about having sex with men. And the crossdressers would rationalize it by saying, I think of you as a woman. So what we're doing is really heterosexual. And hypocrisy is one of the things in life that infuriates me the most. And that certainly did.
It's an interesting phenomenon of needing to, I don't know, for lack of a better phrasing, twist ourselves into pretzels mentally in order to try and make sense out of what somebody else is doing or what we're doing or what we're supposed to be doing and trying to fit some narrative that's been handed down through the generations. And then when it doesn't fit, nowadays, I remember maybe about 15 years ago, within the FTM community, at least, there was a lot of talk about not being trans enough, that people felt like they were getting the message indirectly, predominantly, but sometimes directly, that they weren't trans enough because of how they were presenting. Their gender expression wasn't masculine enough.
We were beating ourselves up and we were getting beaten upon by our peers, which just reinforced our own doubts.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty horrible situation.
It was. I remember being very just confused about it at first and then annoyed. And I had the privilege of being able to lead for a couple of years the FTM support group in San Francisco for FTM International. And I tried my best to keep as much of that out of the discussions. And I didn't want to be an ogre facilitator, but I also tried my best to steer it in a way of, oh, well, thank you for sharing your experience. I'd love to hear other people's experience with that, just to show people there's not one way to be trans. There's not one way to be a trans man. There's no one way to do this. There's no one way to transition. There's no one way to how to identify. We can use all different terms and that's okay. Now, you'll get this and on as well. For people who struggle with identity development, it's going to make it a little more difficult if they're presented with a community that has 30 different labels and about 125 different ways to actualize who are coming from different social contexts, class and religion and race and ethnicity and age, demographics, where we grow up. And so for some people, it's going to be really difficult for them to figure out who they are when presented, almost choice anxiety, but with self identity.
When Anne Boleyn, who's an anthropologist and a friend of mine actually, did her doctoral dissertation in the 80s, she found if you were born male-bodied, there were three career paths that you could take. You could be a crossdresser, you could be transsexual, you could be a gay crossdresser or drag queen, and those communities didn't mix. And if you were transmasculine, you had one choice, which was you had to be very masculine, sexually interested in women. While those were easy choices for many people. Then you end up in the trap we've just been talking about of things not fitting. And fortunately, in the early 90s, we started getting over this. And now, of course, there's what Ann calls a splendor of gender, where people can just go all over the landscape and make their own identities and their own pronouns. And that's just so much more healthy.
Well, to a certain degree, that's part of what I mean by when there's so many options. For some people, it might be more challenging because it's identity, of course, is unique to us, just as our fingerprint is unique to us. At the same time, when there's people who are identifying as inanimate objects or otherworldly creatures or using pronouns that are non-human related, right? I think that might be a bit of a challenge for people who struggle with needing a bit more structure around identity. But then I think it also can open us up to ridicule by people who want to find anything to ridicule about.
For that reason, I am a little bit sad that terms like transsexual are becoming obsolete, because that is a handle. I identify both as transgender and transsexual. And that transsexual identity differentiates me from other people in the gender spectrum, people who use that term, what they're wanting to do. And so I see your point. And yeah, things can get really out there. And we get called upon that by the right wing all the time.
I got caught up in the series as my son, Ari, turned me on to it. And it's called Altered Carbon. Have either one of you seen that?
I think I watched part of the first one, and it's on like Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah, it's on Netflix. Well, it was. I don't know about now, but I liked it so much because it illustrated how people switched with other human beings. So you could be a white person, and the whole process is to avoid death. And there were these groups of people who were saying death is a natural part of life. So we don't want to continue doing this. We want to ultimately put ourselves to rest as we were meant to be. And so Altered Carbon is all about gaining access and entry into other people's existence. So you could end up Asian and a police officer. I'm not really verbatim translating this, but just to give you a general sense of what was going on in this series. And I thought it was quite interesting. And I also thought it's typical of some of us who get drawn into those narratives, because it's a creative way, I think, sometimes of allowing other people to experience change. Of course, that was more of a dramatic change, going from white to maybe a black man or an Asian female. But it was pointedly, I think, created for a purpose. And I don't know what the purpose was. I haven't looked into it. I thought it was remarkable.
I loved Sense8 for the same reason.
Ah, yeah.
People sharing realities. And it does help to have role models, and it does help to have ideas about where you're going. As long as it doesn't stop people from making other choices, it's all good. So I think we're in a good place overall, but we're going to be ridiculed by the right no matter what we do.
Speaking of the word transsexual, it was a couple of years ago that the International Olympic Committee created some guidelines of standards for journalists that was recently reintroduced because the Olympics are coming up. And so these are guidelines for journalists who are covering the games and reporting on the athletes. And there is a list of verboten terms, and the word transsexual is on there as a do not use term. Now, these aren't binding. They're not going to kick somebody out for using them, but they're requesting that people don't use it. And it mentions that GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, was one of the organizations that maybe they consulted with. And I think that transsexual is on their don't use it list as well. And as a transsexual myself, I use that term. It saddens me a little bit that this term has become considered don't use. Now, I get suggesting to people that you shouldn't use the word when speaking about somebody else that you don't know what term that they use, that they prefer to be used, or that they use for themselves. Calling everybody who's trans a transsexual, that'd be inappropriate. For somebody to say, oh, Xander, he's a transsexual, that shouldn't be off limits because that's what I call myself. And so it does bother me that the word itself, there's no context whatsoever. It's just on a list of don't use these. Another one is FTM and female to male, and MTF and male to female. These are also on the list of do not use, which I find really troubling.
Give me the history on that. How did we get there? Who determined all that?
Most of the names we were originally called were given to us by sexologists in the late 1800s and early 1900s, transvestites from the Latin. And transsexual, which Harry Benjamin settled on when he was writing his book in the 60s, doing his work in the 50s and 60s. And those were the choices we had. Those were the two labels. Pick one. That's who you are. And we started, crossdresser started coming into focus in the 70s and 80s. But transsexual, even though it's not about sex, it's about gender, it just stuck on into the 90s. And a lot of trans people now find it offensive, but you have no right finding my identity offensive. Just look after your own self. And I got called out about that. The other thing is, if you're talking about a historic period, oftentimes, we don't know what individual a person used. I mean, we don't know how they identified. We don't know if they were, in fact, trans or not. And we're non-binary. We can only make educated guesses. And that became an issue for me and my three co-editors in a book about the history of transgender medicine. We were having discussion about a lot of people historically. We actually did two focus groups. One was at Fantasia Fair to get some feedback from community and trying to figure out what do you call someone when you don't know their pronouns. And the main feedback we got was that history is important. And so if someone did something in one gender and then transitioned, we should use the gender they were in. And this is from trans people at the time. The other thing is, I got called out giving a talk about someone who was using the word transsexual, and someone considered it offensive and said so. And I said, well, at the time at which I'm talking, the term transgender was not in common use. It was one of a thousand terms, and that was how people identified. And it's not right to take a modern term and push it back on historic times. So what would you have me use? And they didn't have an answer for that.
Yeah, I think we get into trouble with revisionist history, which I get the impulse, but I think I agree that when I talk about my childhood, I'll use words like childhood, but every once in a while, just contextually, it's important that I'm speaking about being a little girl. It matters to the story. And so I will say it, or I'll insert it into something I'm writing. I have no problems with that. I don't have any issue with acknowledging that I have a female sex, because if I didn't, then I wouldn't be a transsexual. Right? I think that's one of the differences I see when I'm interacting with people, is some of the transgender people I know, they dismiss the biology of sex. And so they're not transsexual because they haven't. And I don't believe that because I'm on hormones and had surgeries and changed my sex marker legally, that I have physiologically changed my sex. But the way I present to the world is very different. I noticed that that's one of the areas. You said something about the words came from researchers, Harry Benjamin, and then at the Institute in Germany. Now, you mentioned Virginia Prince earlier, and she used the word transgenderist, which never really took off because transgender became more popular. And maybe it's because transgenderist was very specific to that cross-population of people who went from part-time to full-time cross-dressing, didn't want to have quote-unquote SRS or sex reassignment surgery, as they called it in the day, but were taking hormones likely. And so they were presenting as women full-time. I get it. I get that to have a term that's unique to that.
She felt a little bit offended because it stole her identity, or she felt that it did.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour is Dallas Denny, who is an applied behavior analyst, writer, editor, and musician. We will take our first commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active, available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. This is Dr. On with Xander Kagg, and our guest this hour is Dallas Denny. Let's get back to where we left off.
The first time I heard the word transgender, in the 90s, I was working in the GLBT student services office. It was in my 30s at college in downtown Denver, Colorado. And we had a women's bookstore in town. And Leslie Feinberg came to read her new book, Stone Butch Blues. And she used the word transgender. Now, working in a GLBT student services office, the T wasn't transgender. It was trans. It was just the prefix. And I remember being told by the director that that was because there were transsexuals and transvestites. And she might have said the word transgender, but I don't remember. And she wanted people to know that that professional office for students was open to anybody that we would now say is trans spectrum identified. But it was when I went to go hear Leslie Feinberg read from Stone Butch Blues and then answer questions afterward that she used the word transgender. And somebody asked her, what is that and what does it mean? And she said, a transgender person is anybody who transgresses gender norms, gender roles, gender, what we would call now the gender binary, which was very different from what transsexuals were doing. Because if you were gender nonconforming and you were a dyke, you could be transgender. In that definition of transgender, it's taken on a whole different meaning now. So I remember back then, so that was like maybe 1997, I started referring to myself as, well, a tranny, because that was the word that was more popular in the community. But I started using that word, and that was many years before I started.
When I first came into the community, and now, of course, it's the worst word possible. RuPaul got in big trouble for using it.
Well, it came from drag culture. I love that term. I think it's funny. It's unfortunate that it became used within the porn industry. There's a lot of words that people reclaim, right? People have reclaimed dyke, queer is being reclaimed. I don't know why we can't reclaim tranny.
So I've never seen so much assault on the use of language as it is in our community. It's perplexing to me. It's moving at such a rapid rate.
A rocket, isn't it?
I shared this with Xander that I was hanging out with my partner's group. She works with veterans of Cohen Clinic. They have families and sometimes they have get-togethers. And we happen to have an evening, one evening. And so I went. And one of the therapist's husbands, he said, it's so confusing. Didn't you have a show about pronouns? And I thought, well, it's confusing because it's such a rapidly evolving world that our heads spin. Even my head sometimes spins when I use a word and then I'm left feeling I assaulted someone when that was never my intent. But that's how it's perceived. And we have all these rules, and then some acknowledge the rules and many do not want to acknowledge the rules. We are left appearing perhaps to the mainstream public. We're so confused. We're not confused. We are grappling with an ever-changing, ever-evolving world.
We absolutely are. One of the things that we realized in writing that book on the history of transgender medicine is that whatever language we do settle upon and use will be obsolete by the time the book goes into print. I think we say so, actually, in the preface.
That's good. A little disclaimer right up front might be a good CYA. I had an experience a couple of years ago where I was a Facebook Live discussion with the National Association of Social Workers. Somebody was asking a question about pronouns, And I said, people are pretty familiar with the they, them, Zer. Maybe the they, them is more familiar to the majority of people, but within the LGBT community, we've seen other pronouns over the years. But I said, now with neopronouns, things are very different because, as I mentioned earlier, they could be animals, inanimate objects, otherworldly things, spiritual things. And so I said, for example, I have met a couple of people who use the pronouns it and itself. And then I made a statement about how I will never refer to a human being as an it. I think it's dehumanizing. So they can request it. What I'll do is I'll use their name instead. So I'll refer to them by their name. And that actually got me in quite a bit of trouble. There was a NASW chapter, one of the state chapters, that issued a mass announcement denouncing me and my transphobia and the harm I was causing. I had already been booked to be a plenary speaker at another NASW state chapter conference, and they canceled my gig. People were getting negative comments on the recording that was on Facebook after the live for this very statement. And I think partly it was because people didn't believe me that there were people who wanted to be referred to as it and itself. And it's more popular now than it was even a couple of years ago. Those are the consequences that can happen when you're out of step. And so whenever I do a training or I'm talking about trans stuff, I let people know, one, I'm only speaking about my experience, and anecdotally, I can give you some information that I've heard from other people. I say we're a fluid, we're a dynamic community. We're constantly evolving. And so there's no way to stay up to date. Nobody is going to be up to date. And it changes based on where you are in this country, East Coast to West Coast or the middle. It depends on what other country you're in. There's no way, if you're on social media or not, there's no way anybody is completely up to date on all the terms.
Reason I'm smiling is because Heather, my wife, tells me my pronoun is the. My name is fairly uncommon. Both of them are. But the reason is when the book Trans Bodies, Trans Selves was about to come out, there was a reception for all the many authors in Harlem in New York. And we went up there and I was being filmed to do a little promo for the book by this young non-binary person in the middle of filming, just breaks down and starts crying and says, I can't believe I'm filming the Dallas Denny. And Heather has called me the ever since. It's just funny. So pronouns can be funny. I was confused for a while about they, because it's ordinarily a plural pronoun, but it's used as a single pronoun. What do you then use for several people who identify as they? Is that they? And I asked the non-binary people, I said, well, we're confused about that too. So we usually just say they all, like you all.
That's right. Yeah, because they's probably doesn't have a ring to it. Well, speaking of books, I mean, you are quite prolific in all the books and the chapters that you've contributed. When we spoke prior to the recording, you had mentioned that you had two books currently in press. So that means they're not yet published, but they're on their way. What are these two books about, and when might we be able to get our hands on them?
The first is called A History of Transgender Medicine in the United States. It's in press with SUNY Press and will be out in February. The first author is Carolyn Wolf Gould, physician, me, Jameson Green, and Kyan Lynch, who is a physician also and a trans man. We have about 40 or almost 50 contributors. It's a huge book. I'm just wrapping up a book. Right now I'm checking references because the book is actually completed, but it's a book about Virginia Prince because A, she played a significant role in my life early on, not a positive one. And you're laughing because you've heard about Virginia and it's all true. And second, because in 1995 at Fantasia Fair, we were assigned as roommates. And I was having problems with her membership criteria, no transsexuals, no gay or bisexual crossdressers could not be in the group. Yet at the same time, we were collegial, she being resolute about the requirement and me trying to tell her that it's not necessary. But I recorded her over the course of the week of Fantasia Fair audio and eventually transcribed it. And I have about, I don't know, 150 pages of manuscript text, and recounts of my experiences with Virginia are going to be in a book that's out. No date yet, but it's from Transgender Press in Victoria, British Columbia. But my first experience with Virginia was 1979, after I'd been rejected by the gender clinic at Vanderbilt. I see a group of crossdressers on daytime TV, and it's very clear it was Trias, Society for the Second Self, and it was very clear I was not welcome to be a member. So I wrote a letter And I told him I understood I was not eligible to be a member and I wasn't asking to be a member, but I figured surely they have to know somebody like me. And can you please put me in touch with someone who knows something about transsexualism? So they gave me Virginia Prince's name and address. Well, of course, she's known for her anti-transsexual views and writings. I poured out my heart in a somewhat pompous letter because I was trying to impress her with how, I was 29 maybe, how professional I was. And she wrote back a letter that just destroyed me because she told me I could never be a female. Now, at the time, almost no one on the planet was differentiating between sex and gender. They were one and the same. John Money's lab with the Hansons, he differentiated sex into a whole bunch of components, internal, external genitalia, chromosomes, hormonal state, gender identity, gender role, all kinds of stuff. But Virginia knew about that, but I didn't, and almost everyone in the world didn't know about that. So I thought she was telling me I could never be a woman. So although she gave me some helpful advice, I'm like, oh my God, I'm two strikes, Vanderbilt Gender Clinic in Virginia, and I did not join the group. And it took me another 10 years to find community. And the way I found community after all that time was I held my nose and I joined TRIAS. Both of those letters, by the way, hers to me and mine to her, and on my website. I retained them. So my reasoning was the same. There has to be some interaction between transsexuals and these crossdressers. And sure enough, after 4 or 5 months, in comes someone with a copy of Tapestry with their wonderful listing at the time of all these sources for support and treatment in back. And I found a support group in Atlanta, which was not too far from where I lived. And I finally started meeting my peers and knew other transgender people. It was an odyssey for me. I was ready to go when I was 13. If I was 13 today, in the environment of today, I would be pushing to transition because it's what I wanted, but it took me forever to make it happen. Unfortunately, those 10 years on hormones really made it easy when I did transition. I was not fighting my body like I was in my 20s.
I bet.
We are taking our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg, and our guest this hour is Dallas Denny. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Delightful news, air travelers. Going in and out of airports without getting sick can be challenging. Time to take charge of the air you breathe with Nasal Guard. Nasal Guard topical gel defends by blocking harmful airborne particles and viruses. Try Nasal Guard for air travelers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On with Xander Keg, and our guest this hour is Dallas Denny. Let's pick up where we left off.
One thing I was thinking about with your book that's going to be coming up about transgender medicine, I'm wondering if you have had a chance to read the final report from the CAS review from the UK. And
I've looked through it and it's so offensive and it's just such pseudoscience, like J. Michael Bailey's book. It's just trash. It's just like Janice Raymond's book, The Transsexual Empire. It's not science. I looked up Janice Raymond's dissertation at Emory University in Atlanta, and she talks about her subjects in her book. And I read her dissertation, and there were no subjects. She said there were subjects, but there were no subjects. There was no methodology. It was just a 200-page rant. And I have considered, well, I'm going to write a letter to Boston College and suggest she does not deserve the PhD she got, because it's, in my opinion, fraudulent if you say you have subjects and you don't. All of her quotes in the book came from a letter written by Angela Keys Douglas with, I can't remember the name of the woman who was, Kay Brown was standing over Angela's shoulder and urged her not to send it to a lesbian magazine called Sister. And that's where Janice got all the quotes in the book. It was a sarcastic letter, you know, in which Angela says, we're better than biological women, so we're coming, get ready for us. But it was sarcastic, and of course, that's not how Janice played it. Probably the most offensive book I've ever read, and I would feel that way if I was not trans. One of the things I like to rant about is Janice.
Yeah, well, I remember that book.
It did a lot of harm.
Before I transitioned, of course, I was part of lesbian community. And back then, definitely in the 90s, if you were engaged in lesbian community, you heard about the transsexual empire, you know, the making of the she-males.
Well, her mentor, Mary Daly, called transsexuals Frankensteinian. So that's where she was schooled, I think. What's most offensive is she went around and campaigned and got excluded from insurance coverage for 20 or 30 years. So screw her.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that she was very much involved in that, actively involved. I don't know if she was a consultant or was brought in, what, during the Reagan administration to look at the government agency that deals with Medicaid and Medicare.
Yeah, I have a report that she filed. I haven't looked at it in a long time, but yeah. It had some clout wherever it landed.
This history is so important.
In the 90s, I started the Transgender Historical Society as a division of Aegis, and no one was interested. I think we were just busy trying to survive. And in 2000, after having had nothing, two rooms of my house were devoted to the transgender library and archive that I started with Aegis. And in 2000, when we became gender education and advocacy and went virtual, it all went to the University of Michigan, to the Labadie collection. And a lot of the stuff on the digital transgender archive comes from there. And I've since sent collections. It filled the largest size U-Haul truck. It was an amazing collection of stuff, and I've since sent collections from three other people who were collectors to different universities. I'm now sending stuff to Victoria, to the Transgender Archive, and to Michigan, and to University of Minnesota, and about to branch out to some others, because some of the people, they have all the books by now. I've sent them so many books, but I'm very proud about that. And that's why I started Aegis, is because no one needs to be in that position of loneliness and fear that I was growing up, and now no one needs to be, no one has to be. And that makes me feel good about my work and my life.
Absolutely. I wanted to just talk briefly about if there's anything else that you'd like to add about the way in which you have been working and will continue to work in the preservation of trans history, if there's anything else you'd like to add to that.
Well, there's a wonderful conference at Victoria every other year in the spring, and it's just wonderful to see all the energy and people interested in transgender history and people writing. I'm getting critiques of my own work done in the early 90s now, which is flattering and scary sometimes by young scholars, but it's all wonderful. At the same time, we're under vicious attack, and I'm very concerned about the future.
Yeah, Moving Trans History Forward conference. I haven't been in person yet, but I have appeared twice, once on an elders panel, which was a little funny because I'm in my late 50s. I represented the 50s. And then there was another gentleman, Charlie Burton, who was in the 60s. And then we had Jamison Green in his 70s and Jude Patton in his 80s. Four of us were on a panel together.
They've not asked me to do that, although I did keynote the very first one. I was very flattered about that. And it's just so wonderful that there's these two huge collections and others around the country where people can go and get this material. I'm excited.
My hope is to one day get there in person, which...
I'm going to be there. I'm not going to miss it. I've missed it because of the pandemic. The one before, because Newark was snowed in and I couldn't fly out. They were going to get me there just after the conference ended, so I didn't go.
Tell me about your music.
Well, I've been writing songs for a long time. And on Saturday, my song, Dark Old Wind, I'm going to be performing it at St. John's in the Village. with an all trans and non-binary choir backing me up. I'm really excited about that. It's going to be film for a documentary that I somehow went from being a talking head to a principal of this movie called Finding Bernie, I guess because the director was unable to find Bernie. And I'm flattered by that too. I'm actually very happy with my life right now in my mid-70s, and I'm hoping I can crank out a bunch more stuff, fiction and songs. Another book I'm working on with Jameson and Bob Davis about how transgender communities found one another. We're just getting started on that one. And I'm going to write a memoir. I really feel like my life is interesting enough that I should tell that story. My senses are holding up, and even though I have a lot of medications and a long list of diagnoses, my joints all work and my brain still works and I still get around. So I hope I can preserve that for as long as possible.
Yeah.
Dallas, it's been wonderful having you on the Umbrella Hour. It's been fascinating, and I especially love all the historical pieces that we covered. It sounds like Dr. On did as well. We always like to let our guests know we would love to have you back again. You know, maybe in like a year, you can let us know what's going on.
I'm still around. I'd be happy. And I've had a great time. Thank you so much, both of you.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour was Dallas Denny, an applied behavior analyst, writer, editor, and musician. We hope that you enjoyed this hour. We look forward to next time. Thank you for listening.